Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Mull, and this is the My View Matters radio network. If you are tuning in for the special, there's going to be some guests with us the second half of the show. They will be talking about the constitutional amendment, the proposed constitutional amendment, for restoring felons' rights in an automatic manner. And we'll get into all that during the second half of the show, but they're going to be here at the bottom of the hour. So stay with us until then, and we have plenty of stuff to cover until that time. So we're going to go through this here, and anybody who's new to the show, welcome. So we begin every show, lightheartedly, with the political rhetoric generator. It's a random generation of political rhetoric. Sometimes it makes a little more sense than others. Usually it's pretty silly. And this week's random political rhetoric is as follows. Unlike myself, my opponent wants an America where drug dealers and flight attendants can make a mockery of our reality TV shows. I always enjoy the rhetoric generator. I think that's hilarious. So a couple of things here, some house cleaning things. We have this best of show, the last show of the year, and I didn't get to this last week, and so I wanted to bring this up. We have, there was a story floating around. People were freaking out about the lead smelting plant shutting down and that it was some sort of backdoor gun control. And, of course, when it comes to gun control, Obama is immediately going to take the blame in the Second Amendment crowd, and, you know, just by default. And to an extent with good reason based on some of his previous rhetoric. But the point, I guess, is that the story of the smelting plant being shut down actually has its origins before Obama took office. The rule change, the issue came up during the Bush administration. The EPA has been after these guys for a good long time. And there's kind of a big, long story behind it. You know, of course, you can go all the way back, but to the point where it's relevant, the EPA has made it so that it is basically impossible to smelt lead, and that is true. However, what's not being reported widely is that the rule change came actually during the Bush administration, under Bush's EPA, and essentially the standards were adopted in October of 2008, which was roughly 1 month before the election in 2008. So these rule changes came into effect prior to the 2008 election, prior to Obama taking office. And I think that's important for people to realize. I am, of course, personally a huge Second Amendment advocate, and I believe everyone has the right to their own self-defense and that they are actually, in fact, the person primarily responsible for each individual is responsible. The primary responsibility for self-defense falls on the individual. That's what I'm trying to say. And as such, I am a large Second Amendment advocate. However, it's important to know where things are happening, and so you get your story straight and you understand the full picture. Just because the rule change is taking effect now, or the effect of the rule change is being felt now, the rules themselves were set up some time ago, and so you have to look into the history of what's going on in order to fully understand the full picture. So essentially, where this all came from was a lawsuit that was filed by a green organization in Missouri in 2004. And as a result of that lawsuit, in 2005, a district court in Missouri agreed and ordered the EPA to conduct a review of its policy standards surrounding lead. And apparently this plant had issues prior. They had been cited by the EPA several times. You know, lead is a pollutant, and so you do have to take care and take caution when it comes to dealing with lead. And anyone who is a large Second Amendment advocate knows You don't want to be at a range, for instance, an indoor range, without proper ventilation because you don't want to be consistently breathing lead dust. You can get very sick from that. You can get lead poisoning, and not in the joking lead poisoning way, the real lead poisoning way. And the point is that there is a good reason to prevent people from polluting, putting lead into the atmosphere. This company was putting lead into places that were in the area, right? It was polluting more than just their property. It was polluting other people's property. And so that's a bad thing. And so the lawsuit went through. It forced the EPA to go over its rules. The EPA did go over its rules and implemented those in October of 2008. And this all happened before Obama took office. Now, you can argue whether or not it was right or wrong for the EPA regulations, whether the regulations themselves are too stringent or not. We can argue over that stuff, and that's fine. That's a legitimate debate to have. But when it comes down to the articles that were floating around from certain right-wing propaganda news sources, they were basically trying to blame the Obama administration for this. And in reality, other than the fact he didn't stop it, Obama's administration didn't really have a hand in this. And so it's important to know that stuff. I want people, if you're going to argue over an issue, you got to have the facts, and you got to have your facts straight. And one of the key things is you need to look into these issues deeply because, and I'm telling you, I'm noticing it more and more, the media is getting more and more biased on both sides, and it's harder and harder to dig into the truth of what's really going on a number of issues. Anything that's politically charged at all is extraordinarily difficult to dig into and find the truth. Everybody wants to politicize everything. Everybody wants to win points. And, you know, in this time of continued economic strife, it's stepped up maybe tenfold. It is much harder to get unbiased real news than it was 5 or 10 years ago. And some people blame the Internet. I disagree. The Internet is what's making it possible for us to actually do the homework, to dig in, to find out what's really going on. And so I don't blame the Internet at all for existing or for the problem of news agencies significantly slanting their news. I do think the Internet and Internet users in general, like myself and obviously you, should be very careful about when we receive those emails that have been forwarded 1,700 times and all of that. Do your due diligence. Look into it. Find out if it has any grain of truth to it or not. And please, please don't be one of those people that just forwards emails on. Please. I ask that on behalf of people who receive those things on a nonstop basis. I promise you I've seen it before. And most of the time the things are very obviously not true, and it takes like 3 minutes to completely debunk those things. It's just like the big complaints about the 2012 election and claiming that Romney actually should have won. Yeah, there were problems in a few places, but there were also places where if you did the analysis, you dug in and found out what was going on. For instance, the big complaint about Florida having 140-something percent turnout in certain precincts, it was really easy to find out what was going on there. The really easy thing was they had two ballots there. There were so many things on the ballot, they created two ballots. But what was happening was, as one person walked in and used both ballots, they'd say, well, two ballots were cast for that person. And so that threw the math all off. And if you look at from that perspective, then what you have to do is take the turnout number, divide it in half. That's really the real turnout number. And so 70-something percent turnout is completely in line. There's nothing fun, no funny business there. Some of the precincts that they whined about in certain areas, about how it was 100% for Obama, well, that's because those districts were gerrymandered into the urban core and made that way. And it's actually kind of funny how that all works out in different stupid civil rights cases. And I don't mean to say civil rights are stupid, but the cases were stupid because they conflict with one another on their answer. Some places get mad at you for gerrymandering districts that are too much of a minority. Some say it's not enough of a minority, and depending on what state you're in, it governs your different set of rules, and it's so crazy. But the point is that you got to look into this stuff. Don't take stuff at face value, and please, I tell you guys in the audience all the time, don't take my word for it. Do the research. Please, do the research, because I'm trying to help you understand what's going on, bringing this information to you. But I've been wrong before. I'm not a perfect person. And in a lot of cases, you know, I can't know what's really going on the ground in some of these cases. There were plenty of precincts in Ohio that were in question, for instance, that I can't get a definitive answer on. There may have been voter fraud in those areas. However, that said, it's up to the campaigns that were affected. They're the ones who should be bringing the complaint. And if they don't, then they're conceding. And if they're conceding, then there's really nothing you can do. You can whine and complain. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was your team, go team, your team's job to bring that up. And if they didn't, well, then that's their own fault. Switching gears a bit, I think it's interesting. Obviously, Edward Snowden has been a very controversial figure. I don't know that I would have done what he did. He wasn't in his position. But the net outcome of what he's done, I would say, is a good thing, in that the American public is now more aware of what is being done in their name. And in our system of government, where the voters are responsible for keeping the check and balance on our government by electing people to do our bidding, it is important to have that transparency, to have that ability to say, hey, this person supports or doesn't support this particular program. Well, what is this particular program? From the outset, you know, hey, these guys are keeping us safe from terrorists. Okay, well, who wants to work against it? Who wants to make the country, who wants to make us vulnerable to terrorists, right? Nobody would ever campaign on such a thing. There is a question of methodology. What is it that you're doing to keep us safe from terrorists? And it's one thing to guard borders. It's another thing to go fight wars in other countries, and it's another thing entirely to spy on the entire American public. Those are three very different things. And so the question is, where do you stand on that, of course? Now, I know where I stand. I personally believe that keeping it out of our borders, right, and that's I look at it at the border of our country, is where the efforts to fight terrorism should start and end. We have no business dorking around in other countries. And I don't believe the government has any right to spy on anyone without due process or probable cause. And I think more and more people are getting that. And I think they're getting that as a result of the information that was exposed by Edward Snowden. Now, there was a big discussion I was involved in here recently, where a number of people were calling Snowden a traitor and that he should be hung and all this stuff, and that he did horrible damage to the country. As far as I know, I haven't read anything, Snowden has not done anything horrible to the country other than expose the fact that everybody's being spied on. It didn't even stop the spying. They're still doing it. What damage has been done? We've all learned what metadata is, and we've learned how powerful it is. And we talked about that on a show, months ago, about the metadata, that what you can do with metadata and cross-referencing it with public databases and public information is simply amazing. There was a legislator in, I think it was Germany, who used the metadata and cross-referenced metadata from his cell phone to his public speaking schedule, and they were able to determine every step of every minute of the day for that guy. And that's a little weird and a little scary. We talked last week, I think, about the story about how metadata can be used. It doesn't tell you the content of the conversation is not exposed, but you could find out things, you can extrapolate things from where and when and how long conversations are going. For instance, if you call a suicide hotline from the Brooklyn Bridge and talk there for 45 minutes, it's kind of clear what you're doing. And the point is that it is important that we know this information, that what our government is doing in our name, not necessarily the nitty-gritty details. All right, there is a place where security can play a role. But I don't believe most Americans really knew that our government was spying on all of us to the extent that they were. Part of the conversation went to, well, they should have gone through proper channels. Well, there's a whole bunch of people who have gone through proper channels. And those people, you've never heard of them. And you never heard their complaints. Because the proper channels covered all of that up. You never heard about it. And so faced with the same decision, I can't say I would do what Snowden did, but it would be one thing. I mean, what good does taking things to public channels do? And I guess the most ironic thing of all, you know, we heard about the whistleblowers and especially from the left, they were screaming about protecting whistleblowers. That was one of the things that Obama campaigned on in 2008. But they've prosecuted more whistleblowers. And they've done the opposite. And I'm a little bit frustrated with that whole thing because we shouldn't even need whistleblowers. Our government should not be operating in a way where it takes a whistleblower for us to find out what's being done in our name. It's our government. They are acting in our name. We elect them. So it's critically important that we know what's going on. And at least for now, as far as I'm aware, Snowden hasn't revealed anything completely critical that really puts anybody's life in danger other than, again, that we actually know what they're doing. They haven't stopped doing it. On the whole, I would say what Snowden has done was a good thing. On the whole. I may not have done exactly what he did, but hey, we're all better informed for it. All right, boy, switching gears again. as everyone, I'm sure, knows, Colorado legalized the recreational sale of marijuana on January 1st. And there were a number of places, it's all numbers that they had sold over $5 million worth of marijuana over the first week, which is a lot of money. Now, they passed a special sin tax on marijuana of a 10% tax. And I'm not sure if that's on top of regular sales tax. I don't know. But I know that there's a 10% special tax on marijuana. So assuming they raised $5 million in 1 week, that means they raised $500,000 in tax money over that same period. And what that really means is there's extrapolated out, assuming sales stay the same, you're going to see $260 million worth of marijuana sold in 1 year. And the state will get $26 million in tax revenue. Now, in the grand scheme of things, the tax money, $26 million, isn't much. It's not. But what you will see, and this has always been the hard part, the hard thing to calculate, is how much will be saved, how much won't be spent. The police officer's time, there's the jailer's time and the jail staff, there's the court staff, there's the facilities themselves for incarceration. There are lots of costs involved that are not necessarily hard costs and are more difficult to calculate. So what's going to be interesting to see is over the next year, for 2014, what the costs of incarceration and court costs and police officer time, if any of that stuff goes down, It'll be very interesting to see if the state saves money there, then the $26 million that they're going to gain in theory is just a bonus. Because I would venture to say that most of the savings not going to be, or most of the gains are not going to be that tax. What you're going to see is that the savings on all the other costs are going to be the main reason why it's a success. And that's where I think that's going to go. The interesting thing, story came out here, I guess this is yesterday, about the marijuana dispensaries, whether they're medical marijuana or now in Colorado, the full-blown legalization marijuana stuff. Banks are not wanting to do business with the businesses that are selling marijuana. And though it is legal in the state, the banks are fearing a federal raid or some sort of sanctions from the FDIC or from whoever, right, some regulatory body. And so these companies are having trouble figuring out what to do with all this money. And they give a story about Seattle, Washington, where a medical dispensary owner had to go pay his taxes with a paper bag full of money because no one will do business with them, and no bank will do business with them. And I think that's very, very interesting because this is that weird area we're in where states have legalized, but the feds have not, and so there's these weird little hiccups in everything. And one of them is that the banks are basically refusing to do business with these companies. And I think that's really interesting. I don't know how that's going to get resolved. It's going to be very, very interesting, to say the least. Speaking of banks, there was an article right on the new year about J.P. Morgan talking about the era of central bank-driven equity rallies. In other words, the big banks, the central banks, the national, the various world central banks, you know, doing things with the currency to try to cause market rallies. And, you know, there's a real big problem with that because these banks also invest. And so they can, in essence, manipulate the market and make their own, you know, they can profit off of screwing around with the market. Now, some would say, well, you know, hey, you're a libertarian. You know, aren't you for that? I mean, business, no regulations. Well, ideally. But reality is that we have lots of regulations. And we have one central bank, the Federal Reserve, which, for those that are unfamiliar, is not a government entity. It's as some like to say, it's as Federal Express. But we have laws on the books that are protecting it as the core bank of the U.S. And everybody else has to live by their rules. And there's not real competition in the banking sector. And in fact, the rules that came out specifically harmed small banks. They punished the small banks, even though they hadn't really done anything wrong, and back the big banks. And I would say they've made the situation worse by doing so. But I think that that's something to watch, that the banks are now, you know, admitting, and in fact they are almost beating their chest proudly, that they're able to cause market rallies. And, you know, certainly that presents a conflict of interest in a monopoly scenario, or almost a monopoly scenario, at least an oligopoly scenario. And yeah, you've got two directions to go. You can either completely overregulate and completely take for the banks from a government level, or you can go the other way, which is the way I would prefer, which is to deregulate and let those big banks fall on their face and die next time they do something stupid, and they will, and let the little bank, the little guy, grow their business. Let them succeed. And we've talked about this on the show before. I'm sure you guys have seen, everybody has seen, that these small community banks are all of a sudden folding up into the big banks. And the reason is because of the new regulations basically are very punitive towards small banks, asking them to do things that in some cases are just not possible for the smallest of the banks. And the downside is that means they can't, there's less competition, which again gives them even greater license to abuse the system. That's frustrating. All right. Switching gears here, I got a couple more topics before we get to the break, and I want to get to them here. For those that haven't been following the smoking ban issue in the state, there's always been a push now for the last, 4, 5, 6 years to try to get a statewide smoking ban passed. And it runs different phases each legislative session. And this year, I don't know what's going to happen to it. In case you're wondering, I'm dead against the smoking bans. Less harmful would be letting local communities decide, so I'm less against that than a statewide ban. But the reality is that they're not necessary. And not to get into all of that, because that in itself can be a half-hour conversation. But what's interesting is Bullitt County. Bullitt County was the genesis of a lawsuit. In Bullitt County, the Board of Health, the County Health Department, regulated in a smoking ban, claiming that they have broad powers from the General Assembly to do so. The General Assembly did pass a law many, many, many years ago that gave health departments leverage. The idea being, in the case of an epidemic, some sort of Spanish flu breakout or whatever, that they have the ability to deal with the situation. But that has now been extrapolated into secondhand smoke. And that's the reasoning they've used to create their own regulations without enabling legislation at the county level to regulate in a smoking ban. The Bullitt County Fiscal Court and most of the cities in Bullitt County sued when this occurred, basically saying, we have the legislative authority in this county. You do not. And you don't have the right to pass this ban. And that lawsuit is currently in the Court of Appeals. Meanwhile, in Bullitt County, the fiscal court is now looking to pass a smoking ban of their own. Now, the smoking ban fiscal court is looking to pass is far less reaching than the smoking ban that the health department tried to regulate in. It still hasn't been implemented because it's been in the courts. The fiscal court wants to ban smoking in all government-owned buildings. And I'm good with that, man. You can't not go pay your taxes or not show up in court or whatever. There are many things with government that you cannot choose not to do. They're the one agency or one organization that can actually force you to do something. But the point is that this is the difference between legislating something and regulating something, and why it's important that issues be legislated and go through the legislative process. In a way, it's much like due process, right? A law has to be debated. It has to be legislated. The executive has to agree to implement it, and the judiciary has to check to make sure it's cool. And when a regulatory body, which is part of the executive branch, creates law out of thin air and cuts out the legislative process, then you've inherently broken what we're supposed to have. The legislators are supposed to create law, not the regulators. and not the executive. Boy, I'm over the time. I got to take a break. All right, folks, when we come back, we'll be talking about the proposed constitutional amendment in Kentucky that will bring forth the ability for convicted felons, once they've served their time, to get their right to vote back automatically. And we'll go over all that here after the break. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back here in just a few moments.
We'll be right back. First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Oh. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And as promised, coming on to the phone here, I'm bringing Tana on the line. Tana, thank you for being on the show today, and you're here to talk about the issue that's been proposed, and it's been talked about for a couple of years, I know for sure, is the issue of restoring voting rights for those who were previously convicted of a felony once they've completed their sentence.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, no, it's pleasure's all mine. So I'm trying to find out here some more details. Why don't we start out with your background? Why are you interested in this issue?
Well, I'll tell you. About 1991, I received a felony conviction. That's after I completed school at the University of Kentucky. I finished with a BA degree in therapeutic recreation. I was also the senior captain of the UK Lady Cats when we beat Tennessee for the SEC championship. And so somewhere along the line, I made some bad choices. I made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake. And so when I was released from prison, that's when I found out that I had lost my right to vote. And so that's why I'm so passionate about House Bill 70, which we are proposing. Is we have to change the Constitution here in Kentucky. Once a person receives a felony, then their right to vote is taken from them, or some people say we give it up.
Right, and I've looked into this issue quite a bit. As I mentioned, this has been floating around for a few years, and the issue at hand is that you can receive a gubernatorial pardon today. There's a process in place to get your voting rights back, but that process is not a guarantee. It's not set in stone. It's very subjective, and I personally also have an issue with the subjectiveness of the process today as defined, because something as essential as voting rights should be a standard process, right? It should be litigated or legislated as a standard process. And not to derail us too much, but I did speak to someone who did get their voting rights restored just by pure coincidence, ran into somebody. And he said basically the process that he went through was you paid $10,000 to $15,000 to the right lawyer who's connected in the right way. And it didn't matter who the governor was. It wasn't Bashir that he got his rights restored. But you donate $10,000 to $15,000, basically, to the correct lawyer, and that lawyer makes it so. And I have a very big problem with that, because that's basically we've institutionalized corruption in that way by not having a standardized process.
Well, what I can tell you is, I don't know about that person's procedure, but I can tell you that it is a disenfranchisement here in the state of Kentucky. I do believe that once you serve your time, for the crime that's committed. And please hear me when I say that the sentence that I received, the 10-year sentence that I received, I should have gotten. I was a menace to society. I broke the law. And Judge Overstreet sentenced me to 10 years in prison. And I did that. I completed my sentence, and I came out into the community. And what they tell us is go out, get a job, get housing, you know, go back, take care of your kids, and we'll see you later. But what has happened is a quarter of a million people, I'm talking about Kentuckians, this is going to blow your mind. There is a quarter of a million people in the state of Kentucky that has lost their right to vote. What I've run into, people who committed sentences 20, 30, 40 years still are petitioning to get their right to vote back. And they have kept a job. They've sent their kids to school. They've done the American deal and still were locked out of the community. So House Bill 70 is so important because what it will do, once we change the Constitution in 2014 is a big year. This is a year that you can submit constitutional changes, amendments. And so this is really huge for the Kentuckians of the Commonwealth, who I'm a member and an advocate for, and I'm a voice for the voiceless. And so we're going down on the 15th of January. We're going to hold a rally at the Rotunda. We're going to lobby that day, and we're going to talk to some legislators. If you ask me today, do we have the vote in the Senate, I would tell you yes. It is so unfair, and I guess I'm the poster child. What happened was when I first received my right to vote, it was under Governor Patton. But Governor Patton missed an indictment number, and I fell back into the process and fell under Governor Fletcher. At that time, he requested a fee, essay, and he wanted us to jump through hoops with three character references. And so I don't know people that haven't committed crimes that can get three good character references. So what that does is if we can pass House Bill 70, it takes the big what the governor has the discretion at any time, any sitting governor, to change the process. That's what we're trying to eliminate. We want whoever the next governor is, and I have to give my kudos to Governor Brashear. He came in and he changed what Fletcher had in place. And so it's a easier process, but it's not the best process. We're asking for automatic restoration of voting rights once a person, non-valid, once they have served their sentence and paid all restitution. That's what we're asking. Yep. And the biggest thing is we want the Kentuckians to decide. We want the voters of Kentucky to decide, not the Senate people telling us, no, we're not going to call it up for a vote. We just want them to call it up for a vote and get it out to the people and let the people decide whether a person should go on for the rest of their life to pay for a crime that was committed 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and Tana, I see here your friend Michael has joined us, and I'm going to bring him on here now, too. He just – Michael, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, can you hear me? We can.
All right.
Thanks for joining in as well. And, Michael, do you want to give your quick bio and why you're interested in this issue?
Well, okay. My name is Michael Heiser. I'm interested in this issue because I'm a convicted felon. I don't have the right to vote. What I like to say is I'm a citizen in transition. And what that means is I have the right to be taxed, but I don't have the right to vote. And I'm a big advocate for understanding your civil duty and voting to make changes in your community. When I got out of prison in 2007, after 4 years, my life had changed, and I wanted to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem anymore. So I set out to change my life. I went to college. I got an associate's degree in human services, went and got a bachelor's degree in pastoral ministry, became a licensed minister, went on to, in the middle of my master's degree, for licensed marriage and family therapy, became a teacher at the community colleges, and got custody of my children back, paid $15,000 in back taxes. Now, after doing all that, I go up to cast my vote, and they say, well, you can't vote. You're a felon. You've lost them for life. And then you've got a couple of guys who say, but we just think that there ought to be a time limit on it. Like Hornback, he wants to put out a bill that says, well, there should be a time limit on it when you get out of prison. And I have to ask the guy that, you know, what right gives that he has to put double jeopardy into effect. I was sentenced to for a crime. I did my time. Not only did I do my time, I did all of the parole. After doing all of the parole, I've made sure that all of my restitution has been paid. I'm trying to be a part of my community again, but I'm disenfranchised because I can't be a part of my community if I can't vote. And I don't think that I should be paying taxes if I'm not a citizen. I don't think that you should be able to say that I can. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you bring up a very good point, and this is where I was going to go with this, is that in theory, you know, it should be a matter of, if you're convicted of a crime, you do your time, you pay your restitution, you've made yourself whole with the community. That's the idea behind that, right? You've done what is necessary to pay back the community and whoever it is you harmed to, you know, be done with it. Once you've done your time, once you've made it whole, once you've gone through the whole rigmarole, you are essentially given your rights back.
Right.
You're still not quite a full citizen at that point, are you? You don't have the right to vote.
Right. Well, what they're saying is, what they're doing is they're making a person more likely to actually go back out and commit crimes. And the reason I say that is because if I'm not accepted into my community, then I don't have any skin in the game in my community. And
yeah, exactly.
For me to be able to go in and cast a vote would be to feel a part of my community. And once I feel a part of my community, that endows me with a civic duty to protect my community, not to be a blight on my community. But if I'm not a part of my community and they don't want me to vote and I'm not allowed to be a citizen, then why am I here?
And right. I want to bring up one more.
And my whole point goes back to trying to lower the recidivism rate. I tell people all the time, you are going to deal with convicted felons one way or the other. And what I mean by that is that either you're going to be on the front lines. I just walked out of a prison. I've been the chaplain, volunteer chaplain, for three prisons for the last 7 years. Since the day I was released, I've been going back into the prisons to try to make a difference. But you're going to either deal with them on that aspect, or you're going to pay for their incarceration, or, God forbid, you're going to be robbed by them. But one way or the other, you're going to deal with this issue. So let's try to lower the recidivism rate. Let's make them a part of the community instead of trying to push them out like they don't exist.
And there's another point I'd like to make really quick. One out of every five African Americans have lost their right to vote. And that's a high percentage. And so I want to put that in there. I am an African American woman. And just like Michael said, I would rather be a part of my community than to take from my community. So, yes, he's totally right. Going to deal with a felon one way or the other. Why not contribute to the good part? Because, see, before we committed a crime, we had a dream. And then we're back. So we're back in the community.
Right.
Yeah,
I do believe people do mistakes. You know, there are people that you guys both have both paid for the mistakes you have made. And once you've done the time and made up for it and paid everything back, I think exactly what you're saying. If you're going to really be considered a full human being, a full member of the society again, you have to be granted the same rights as people who did not commit the crime, right? Who did whatever, any other person. And I hear from my side that, well, you know, people expressed, well, I love hearing this phrase. People say like, those type of people voting, those felons, you know, they have bad, poor judgment. Punishment was defined ahead of time. Well, I can tell you that, first of all, most felons aren't thinking about at the time of they're committing a crime that they, you know, oh, well, I'm not going to get to vote again. That wasn't what they were thinking about at that time of their life. You know,
right.
And the reality is that's part of why the punishment exists, right, is to make people consider the way of life that the path they're on, and not only pay back for what they've done, but also hopefully, ideally, is to prevent recidivism by having them examine what they've done wrong and choose a different path. The only way, and I think this is 100%, if you don't integrate people back into society 100%, then you are inherently trying to make them antisocial. And if they're antisocial, then they're not going to want to be a part of the community.
Can I say this? The legislative body introduced a bill called House Bill 463. In that bill, they released enormous amount of incarcerated folks back into the community in droves. Now, little do we know that there wasn't anything on the other end to receive them, but if you introduce and you pass a bill, House Bill 463, and you release all of these inmates and you tell them to get a job, well, once they get a job, just like Michael said, if I don't vote, I don't pay taxes. So Uncle Sam, this is the time that Uncle Sam wants his money, or you're going to get a refund. So if Uncle Sam says I'm a citizen, why does Kentucky say that it's going to take a whole lot of stuff in order for us to get our rights back?
Right, Tanya. Tanya, what we've got to understand is that we're not citizens. That's what they're saying. They're saying you're a felon, and you're going to be a convict for the rest of your life. And what we're fighting against is that stigma. I want to be not a citizen in transition, but I want to be a full-fledged citizen. I want democracy to be for all people, not for those who we select. I don't think that anyone has the right, when I've paid for my punishment, to make me pay for the rest of my life. I have done exactly what they've asked me to do, and above that, I've done thousands of hours of community service, and I don't do that to get recognized. I do that because I love my community, and I want my community to grow. And was I thinking of that when I was out doing crack? Was I thinking about that when I was drinking two-fifths a day? No. I was a drug addict, and I needed help. And I got the help that I needed. But now that I'm applying my cure every day, I'd like to be a citizen again. But
well,
I don't
know,
want to be a transitional citizen. I don't want to be a transitional citizen. I want to be a citizen with the right to vote that I can say, as I teach my college class, that I can say that I'm a citizen of America, that I'm a citizen of Kentucky, and I vote. That's what I want to say to my five-year-old son. I want to say
right,
that we vote,
Michael,
so that we can change our community.
Michael, you're right, and you know there's people that cannot fight like we fight, and that's why we're voices for the voiceless. That's why I have a program, Step Into a New Beat. You know, I do it at Total Grace. I do it at the Catholic Action Center. And I work with ex-felons. That's what I do on a daily basis. That's what you do. We're here.
Yeah.
We're not going anywhere. We're here to change Kentucky.
That's it.
Well,
that's it. Our job is to make democracy free.
And I apologize, we're running a little bit short on time here. We got about 3 minutes left, so I want to get to a handful of things and make sure we get them out there.
Go ahead.
So first thing is January 15th. When is that's the rally in Frankfurt. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Where can people find more information about this?
Kentuckians for the Commonwealth website.
www.kftc.org.
Right.
And you can go www.kftc.org. Yep.
Yes. Kentuckians for the Commonwealth.
Or you can find their page on Facebook.
If you search for Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. Okay.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure, I want to encourage people, if you're not familiar with this issue, please take a look at it. I mean, this is a real issue, and it is something of, I believe it's an individual liberty thing. You know, people make mistakes, they pay for those mistakes, and once they've paid for those mistakes, they should be made whole. After they've made society whole, they should be made whole in return. And
so that we can
continue
to make our community whole.
Exactly, and so I want to take a moment to applaud both of you as well, because you've taken what was obviously an unfortunate event in each of your lives and turned that into something positive as well, and you're helping other people as well, and I think that deserves to be applauded as well, because that's a very good thing, trying to help people transition back into society. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Hey, Ken, thank you for having us on. And I feel that I owe my community that. I feel that I owe that to my community for all the damage that I've done. That's part of my repaying community, is getting out there helping others.
Well, and certainly that's a very good thing. And I think that providing the voice for those folks and continuing to help them, I think we all agree, right? We all want people to live better lives, and we all want people to live happy lives. And the only way that we can do that is, you know, after somebody's been punished for their mistake, is make them a whole citizen again, treat them as a human being like everyone else, and that's really the only way that you stop the cycle. And so, I want to thank you both for coming on. Is there anything else in the last minute here you guys want to plug real fast other than the rally?
I just want to say Mission Behind Bars and Beyond. I just want to say Mission Behind Bars and Beyond is a program that we run to try to go in and get convicts into a reentry program. We work with them for a year after they get out.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Katina?
Okay, all I would like to say is thanks to Kentuckians for the Commonwealth for, you know, taking the initiative to really work on this issue. We've been down to the legislative body over 8 years trying to get this passed. We were finally heard on the Senate floor. We're hoping that they do call it up this year. The momentum is really big and it's growing. And I'd just like to thank you. We're a 31-year organization, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. I would like to tell people just go on our website and find out all about us.
All right. Thank you both, Michael, Kana, for being here. Thank you so much. Folks, that's the end of the show, and I want to thank you for tuning in. We are here live every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and hope you'll join us again in the future. If this was your first show, and those of you that are regulars know, you know, we're here every week, and we do our best to bring you the issues in the state. Folks, have a good week. Listen to the other shows on the network. We're here Sunday through Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Until next week, I hope everybody has a good one. And we'll talk again less than 7 days. Have a good night.